Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is sponsored by ChampionshipBreeders.com. Championship Breeders is a proud supporter of the American Kennel Club, our specialty and all breed clubs, our dog sports, and the gifts of therapy and service from our canine companions. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. We are here with all the excitement of Westminster Kennel Club live at the Piers in New York City. And we welcome Klaus DeVern to Pure Dog Talk. Klaus, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Klaus, can you give us just a little bit of a background, your time in dogs?
Absolutely. I started in Golden Retrievers back in the mid-60s and have bred them, bred Labradors, and segued finally into Sussex Spaniels when I saw the writing on the wall that I wasn't always going to be as strong as I was at 25.
Yes. Yes, that happens to all of us.
And I'm very passionate about the function of all of those breeds and have performed with them in hunt tests, in field trials, in obedience, and it's a great life.
And you also judge how many groups now?
I judge sporting group and 9 hound breeds.
Okay.
And I've loved, one of my big things in my life has been to train disaster search and rescue dogs, dogs that were deployed here in New York with 9/11, rescuing them and then turning them into rescuers. It's been a very satisfying life.
Amazing. Amazing. So, Klaus, I would like to talk about one of my favorite topics. I met you in the early 80s, and back in the day, the American Kennel Club did not have a Spaniel Hunt Test program. There was a working dog certificate from American Spaniel Club, and I know that you were very instrumental in creating the Spaniel Hunt Test program for the American Kennel Club. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Because the Spaniels were not yet doing that. I was running dogs in the Retriever Hunt Test program, which was the very first one. Very well developed, got off to a great start, and people were talking about Spaniel tests. When they finally came along, they were primarily adjudicated by field trial people who really, quite honestly, hadn't hunted very much. And your father,
yes.
Errol Reeves,
yes.
And a bunch of other guys, Don Kruger in Wisconsin.
Ruth Tabaka.
Yes, and Ruth Tabaka were so passionate about seeing these dogs doing what they were supposed to do, not competitively, but against a standard. And they were the ones, truly, who were very instrumental in getting it off the ground. And then, most importantly, for people like me with a rare Spaniel breed, they modified it so it wasn't just about speed, and a respect, which is my big word, a respect for differences. Because almost all performance events are predicated on the fastest breed. And Spaniel breeds are not all alike. And so a Cumber can find just as many birds as a Springer or an Ernest Sussex or a Cocker. They just do it differently. And my great joy was to see that your father, when we would talk, how we got that insert into the Spaniel Hunt Test program so that each judge could look at that and say, this is how this dog is supposed to hunt. It was remarkable.
Yeah, I think that is amazing. And they don't have anything in their, either the Retriever or the Pointing Breed Hunt Test that's comparable.
Correct, correct. There we homogenize again, which is always so interesting to me because all of us gravitate towards a breed because it appeals to us.
Right.
I like a lot of breeds, but I gravitate to this one. It's different, so why should we then make it all be the same? So this is one of the great things about the Spaniel Hunt Test program, that we made it different.
And each breed has its own hunting standard.
Absolutely. And judges, when I run my dogs, judges will say, I read it, I read that insert,
right,
as I come with my little brown dog,
right,
to go and find birds.
Right.
No, it's that was a wonderful thing.
right? And I know that you were very, very instrumental in helping move that forward, and I'm not entirely sure that folks could have done it without you.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm the only one with that rare breed, the Sussex Spaniel, and I'm not known for keeping my mouth shut. And so I let lots of thoughts flow out.
Excellent. Yes. Yeah. Excellent. Flowing thoughts is good.
Yes.
Okay. So with the Sussex and working in the hunt tests, talk to us a little bit about what a Spaniel hunt test involves.
Oh, good thing. From junior to senior to master, at these different levels, you are looking for dogs that can find birds on the ground, that they flush them in the air, that they are shot, and the dog delivers them to hand. And successively more difficult terrain, different cover, and more finesse. Dogs that sit after they've flushed a bird, they don't run after it. That's what you would expect from a master dog. And that they hunt for you. That it's not a dog who is 200 yards out there flushing birds that you will never be able to shoot. It is a very practical test. They're also tested in the water, a single retrieve in the water. And one of the things that I've always been concerned about, because what we tend to do here in America, if something is good, then more is better.
Right.
So the standards for the performance is that it really is a bird that would be shot, that would be flying over the water and die over the water. But it's not like a retriever,
right,
a long water mark. They're getting longer.
Are they?
Yes, they are.
Haven't been to a Spaniel hunt test in years.
And I keep saying, guys, go by the guidelines, go by the standard. It's not a field trial, which is competitive.
Right. And so tell us a little bit of the difference, explain for our listeners, the difference between a hunt test and a field trial for Spaniels, also applies for retrievers and for pointing breeds.
Correct. There, in the field trials, it is one dog against another. There are placements, and points are awarded much as they are for confirmation. So those points count towards the field championship. And so it's one dog beating another.
It is a competitive venue.
It's a competitive thing. And it's very exciting to watch. And the level of training on those dogs is remarkable and wonderful. It really has nothing to do with hunting anymore. And that's the difference. And being a purist, I want to see my dogs hunt, because that's what the breed was developed for.
Right.
So if we look at field trials for retrievers, we now see dogs doing 350-yard marks where the bird goes down 350 yards away. You tell me when you could hit a bird that was that far out. They run blinds that are amazing, blind retrieves that can be 400 yards long. So while the training is remarkable, it's no longer the original function of the dog. Those are not gentlemen shooting dogs anymore. They don't hunt for the gun necessarily. Now, the retrievers will duck hunt during the year, but they're not allowed, when they're being competitive in field trials, they're not allowed to run on the upland game stuff,
right,
because they get to think for themselves.
So, which in retriever trials, they don't encourage that.
No, listen to what I tell you.
Yeah,
exactly. Look out there and listen to what I tell you. And it's a little bit the same, not to quite the extent as retriever trials, but you have it with pointers as well. They run much further. An average man or woman hunting over a pointing dog couldn't walk 400 yards for a whole day while their dog is pointing out there. They want their dogs being closer in.
And I think one of the things that we see, at least in the pointing breed field trials, is that the horseback field trial dog is often a hunting dog too.
Yes.
But it knows the difference.
Yes.
You get off that horse, you get on foot, boom,
they
that dog
closer.
brings their range in. And
absolutely,
that is, for the pointing breeds at least, that is something.
Yes.
I will say.
Yes. The difference with trials and hunt tests and real hunting, of course, is that you go out and hunt for a day, and in a test, it's 15 minutes. In a trial, it may be longer, 20 minutes, maybe an hour. So the conditioning for a true hunting dog can often be quite a lot. So
yes,
you can't be just a speed demon and then say, okay, I've done my 15 minutes.
Right. Right.
When your owner wants you to keep on going.
Right. So I think the biggest difference that we see then between the hunt test and the field trials is that the hunt tests are non-competitive. I like to compare it to obedience for people that aren't familiar.
Yes.
And that the field trials are competitive and best dog of the day, more comparable to confirmation.
Correct.
Okay. Very good. So with that, how did you then decide to go from hunt test work and that to search and rescue training? What was the impetus there?
Well, it was interesting. I had a client who had a German Shepherd that had been abused by another trainer. And she came and asked me if I would help her with this dog. And I said, yes. And she said, well, your name was given to me because you trained your own search and rescue dog. And now I would like you to help me with mine. And I had trained my own search and rescue dog. I had a golden retriever. He was a champion. He was a utility dog. He was running in what was then, we didn't have hunt tests yet. We were running in club-sanctioned field events.
Okay.
And I thought, I have this young dog, and I would like to do something for my community. And so a friend of mine who was in search and rescue, she said, well, goodness knows, we have enough earthquakes in California that you could potentially have a dog that could help out. I said, okay. So I trained him. People from Switzerland came over and tested dogs, and he became a certified search and rescue dog. But with my field background, right, I had an edge on a lot of those handlers. They were all amateurs. I was a professional dog trainer. So this lady came to me, and after I had trained her dog and it was certified with FEMA, she said, this is not the best dog, is it? I said, no, we can make it work, but no. And so I helped her get a Labrador Retriever from a friend of mine who bred labs for the field and for the show ring, and trained that dog, and she was certified. And then this lady said she went to Oklahoma City, our first homebred terrorist attack.
Wow.
And she came back from that and she said, this country needs more search and rescue dogs. There were less than 100 at that stage.
So your client went and worked the Oklahoma City bombing?
Oh, yes. She was a handler.
Oh, my goodness.
With that dog. And then she said, I've come home to Southern California. My husband and I have talked about this. We're going to sell a piece of property that we have, and we're going to start a foundation.
Wow.
And she said, my vision is that we rescue dogs from shelters, train them, and then donate them to fire departments, because fire departments are first
responders.
Those are the ones that get to go to the disasters long before anybody else. And she said, would you be willing to train for this organization? And I said, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And so I started training, rescued dogs. We had three golden retrievers were the ones that started us off. One dog that was being euthanized the next day.
Oh, my gosh.
Ended up serving here in New York City, ringing the bell at Dow Jones, being greeted by President Bush. I mean, those dogs did a magnificent job, even though the job was not one where they could find anybody. And that was the beginning of it. And it is going strong. They've built a campus now down in Southern California.
Wow.
But when I turned 72, I said, I don't want to be on a rubble pile in the middle of nowhere, New York State, Oklahoma, in those places. So we have a new trainer, three trainers who are doing it. But the wonderful part of that was that we rescued dogs and turned them into rescuers. I got to train the firefighters. What a bunch of wonderful people
right.
they are. The dogs live with them 24/7. It's amazing.
That is incredible.
Yes.
That is such a great story.
You one quick story. Haiti, the terrible earthquake that they had in Haiti. Our team was deployed. There are two task forces in America, one in Virginia and one in Los Angeles, that are international task forces. They're the only ones that can go to a different country. So the Los Angeles task force are all our guys and gals. They went down there. Very difficult situation. There was not a lot of infrastructure. They saw a lot of poverty, a lot of agony. Anyway, one morning, we get a phone call over the satellite phone, and this captain in one of the Los Angeles departments is crying over the telephone, and we can't even understand him at first. Then he says, Hunter found somebody. We had a find.
Oh my God.
Three little girls, 15 feet below the rubble, lying on the bodies of their relatives. This dog found them. And I'm in tears.
Yeah.
My daughter and my other fellow trainer, we're in tears because all those years were worth it.
Right.
Because we made a difference.
Yes.
It was amazing, fabulous. We were just so excited about that.
That is incredible.
And then it ended up, if you can believe this, it ended up that dog was given the ACE Award at Yukonuba that year.
Excellent. And well-deserved, it
and
sounds like.
And well-deserved.
Awesome.
Yes.
That is such an amazing story, Klaus. Oh, okay. So, slightly emotional there for a minute. I really think that I love the idea that your fieldwork background is being used in the search and rescue years
Absolutely.
Ago. Years ago, I did interviews with narcotics officers using narcotics dogs, and they used washed-out field trial labs.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
High drive.
And, yeah, high drive. And so talk a little bit about the ideal candidate. So your search and rescue dog, what's your best dog for search and rescue? What kind of dog are you looking for? And I don't mean breed necessarily,
no.
but mind.
All right, yes, because while we have purebred dogs, we also have a lot of mixed breeds. First of all, high drive.
Mm-hmm.
High drive by itself is not enough. You have to have high drive, focus, and trainability.
Tough combination.
And in this day and age, after 9/11, every agency that needs dogs goes to shelters. Finding shelter dogs is so difficult. Now, when we look at a dog, not only does it have to have those three things, but then you have to screen them for joint health. Because you can't have a dog on a rubble pile if he has hip dysplasia or elbow dysplasia or a heart condition.
Right.
So one of the good things about going into shelters, of course, is that you can immediately screen the dog for health.
Right.
And then you keep your fingers crossed that all the other things hold true, because one of the things we did discover was that a dog that had all those prerequisites and was just crazed, the sort of dog you and I would not want to live
not
with.
Not want to live
right?
with, no.
After about a month at the kennel, suddenly some of those would settle down, because here they were loved, they were fed, groomed, bathed, trained,
given
all
a
that,
job.
Given a job. And so they were emotionally satisfied. Well, then the ones that weren't really high drive said, hey, this is cool. Oh, but I don't have to do this today. And so, you know, you start defining play drive and prey drive.
Correct.
Because prey drive is forever.
Yes.
And play drive is just when the mood takes them. And so one of the things that we found was, it was sort of funny, but, you know, you're investing a lot of money in these dogs before they get ready to be tested. We had a dog that was a Labrador Coonhound cross. Darling dog. Darling. Great bark, because they bark when they find somebody, right? Except that on any given day, we didn't know if it was the coonhound that was coming out to play or the Labrador. And when it was a coonhound, she'd say, ah, come on, let's do something else. I want to lie in the sun. And then the next day, you know, she'd be a crazed Labrador. Well, since we can't determine when a disaster strikes, we had to drop her. Now, one of the good things that the organization I worked for was that we had a lifetime care policy. So any dog we'd rescued never had to be rescued again.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so you guys are working clearly in a very specific situation where you're doing a lot of good all at the same time.
Yes.
With purebred dogs specifically, are there organizations that are working directly with breeders, or they're, you know, doing any of that kind of thing, and finding or using dogs from breeding programs that are
the only
purposely bred for this?
Right. We've tried it.
Yeah?
Yes. So we had a litter of 7 puppies from a certified search and rescue dog, from a stud dog who had produced service dogs, search and rescue dogs. And of those 7, 2 actually made it.
Interesting.
3 had the drive. 4 didn't. And of the 3 that had the drive, 1 of them had hip dysplasia.
Interesting.
Yes. So it becomes a huge investment in time and money. And you still have to find people who want the puppies. That was definitely higher drive than your average Labrador.
Right.
But not quite enough. So I know that Guide Dogs for the Blind
has a huge breeding program.
But they don't. And they take from breeding program to stud to use. But they're not looking for the same type of dog.
Not at all.
No. Now, in Europe, they breed a lot of Malinois. Mm-hmm. There's a kennel in New York that breeds German Shepherds and have great success. But to produce them on a scale, you have to have a constant supply of dogs to pick the ones from.
Yeah.
That's it.
And so, okay, so you've got these dogs in the shelter. So you go to the shelter and you see one, you're like, okay, let's do this. What is your test? Tell me your testing system.
Yes, the testing is great. So you dangle a toy, a tug toy, or a tennis ball at the end of a rope, and you just sort of run it across the front of the cages, and you see a dog that says, hey, yeah, yeah, following it. You'll take it out. You throw it. You have the dog. See if the dog retrieves it. Doesn't have to bring it back. Okay. It just wants to get it. And then you take time. You throw something, and then you time it for like a minute. And you turn the dog around and then send them out. You throw it into bushes. You throw it across a difficult hedge or something like that. Uh-huh. Does the dog have enough chutzpah to go and keep on going? Mostly, that's what we look for. And then we test them on a surface, because there are dogs who have high prey drive but who don't like being on rubble. Something that's as challenging as concrete and slipping and rebar and all of that sort of stuff. We trained one golden retriever who was quite remarkable, found the victim in a heartbeat, but then would run off the rubble pile and bark up at where he had been and say, it's up there, that poor person is up there hidden. So he went on, and we moved him on to a police force where he became a drug detection dog.
Sure.
Perfect.
Sure.
Right? So it also has to be a dog that overcomes footing difficulties because his prey drive is so strong.
Right. So your
shape is important.
Yes.
You can't have a little dog.
Right.
Right. I had a friend who had a corgi, and she said, you are being so awful and biased against this corgi. I said, that dog can't make it up a sheer rock face. She said, well, you have a point. So it has to have some leg length.
Right.
Border collies, of course, are great, lightweight. Mm-hmm. And we've had the firefighters who've come for their second dog saying, could you get us a smaller one? Because if the dog goes down on the pile, they have to carry them off.
Right.
And that becomes a consideration, too. So a 125-pound dog would potentially break down doing the work, and it would be impossible to get them off a pile.
Right. So you really have
medium size.
Yeah, a definite a target audience, if you will, target market of dogs.
Athletic dogs.
Right.
Yes. And another factor was it are a lot of bully breeds that are in shelters. Mm-hmm. And my golly, some of those tested so high. The problem is that fire departments don't want to be sued. And if a dog inadvertently, and I'm saying inadvertently, bit somebody, if it was a golden retriever, nobody would really think about it. But if it was a pit bull
sad
cross,
but true.
That's a sad reality of it. And so we do DNA screening on every dog that we rescue out of the pound.
Wow, that is some
See,
really...
people don't think about that.
No?
No.
No, very cool stuff, Klaus. All right, so tell me about where you see the future of the search and rescue work going.
I see it going on if they can keep on getting dogs for it. Because even with the development of mechanical devices... Mm-hmm. I haven't found anybody yet by dropping a microphone into a void and and finding somebody. So I think dogs are going to be around for a long time, because what they can do with their noses, we cannot do with technology.
Interesting. And do you find that there is an empathy piece? Like the dogs care?
No.
Really?
Dogs play games. That's what they do. But I can tell you what does happen is that even when they're not finding anybody, they themselves are providing a tremendous amount of sympathy and emotional support for the people whose relatives are under the rubble, and even firefighters who are not necessarily doing search and rescue. So an example was that in California in 82, my dog was called out on a mudslide where we knew people were buried, and they were digging through that horrible stuff day after day, and the dogs would go in rotation and try to find somebody. And this fire captain came over and he said, could I pet your dog? And I said, of course. And he put his arms around him and started to cry. Mm. He'd been out there for days. Mm. And so this dog gave him a way of releasing some of that pain. And we found that at Ground Zero as well. That even if they weren't finding anybody, they were providing tremendous emotional support for a number of people.
Right. In a very emotional situation.
Yeah, just like they do for us at home. Who hasn't sat at, you know, at your dining room table and you've had some bad news and suddenly the dog has a head in there in your lap? Just like that.
Amazingly powerful stuff that you're doing, Klaus. I really appreciate you talking with us about that.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to Laura at puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.